Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on this Wednesday morning, March 26th. Roads appear to be moving smoothly in the Wasatch Back, and weather is slated to be warm today. On the phone with me to talk more about it, I've got ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Good morning, Parker. Yeah, we've got some very nice weather expected once again today. If you liked yesterday, we're going to like today. We're just going to add a few more degrees to that forecast as we go throughout the afternoon hours. So we'll call it mostly sunny skies as we go throughout today. Could see an extra high cloud or two develop late in the afternoon, but it's going to be overall a beautiful day. Highs in the Heber Valley will climb into the upper 70s across the area. And for our friends in Park City, we're looking at high temperatures climbing into the upper 60s to near 70 this afternoon with lots of sunshine. So, yeah, get ready for another nice spring-like, beautiful day across the region. As we go into tonight, we'll see those overnight lows dropping down to near 40 degrees. Our forecast for your Thursday calls for mostly sunny to partly sunny skies, but overall more sunshine than clouds expected for your Thursday. We'll see those highs once again back into the mid-60s in Park City with highs back into the mid-70s across the Heber Valley. So another above average day, but then we start to track some changes, especially as we move towards the end of the week. So as we go into your Friday, look for mostly cloudy skies, and we will introduce and increase those chances of scattered showers as we develop throughout the day. Primarily just some rain showers in the Heber Valley, but could be snow showers in the Park City area as we go throughout your Friday afternoon. Friday night, we'll see those rain showers off and on continuing out there with mostly cloudy skies. Could see a snowflake or two mixing in the Heber Valley with snow showers continuing in Park City Friday night. Overnight lows will drop down to near freezing. And then as we go into your Saturday, look for off and on periods of showers throughout the day. So not the best start to the weekend. Highs will be into the low to mid 50s there in the Heber Valley on Saturday. But we should see highs only in the low 40s there in Park City on Saturday with a chance of morning snow showers out there across the area. As we go on to your Saturday night into Sunday, we'll continue with that chance of a few scattered rain showers mixing with or changing over to snow showers by early Sunday morning. We'll see those overnight lows dipping down into the upper 20s there in the Heber Valley. And in Park City, we're looking at those overnight lows in the 20s as well, with, again, those snow shower chances continuing. It does not look like it's going to be a storm system that's going to add up to a major amount of snow, but it could drop a couple of inches of snow, especially for areas around Park City, with maybe an inch or so as you get there towards the Heber Valley. Again, not a big storm, but something to talk about considering the very nice spring-like temperatures we're going to be dealing with as we go throughout the next day or two. As we get into the beginning of next week, we've got another storm system that can move our way, and that one could also bring us at least a chance of some rain and snow mixed across the Heber Valley and more chances for snow showers in Park City. So while spring is definitely going to be springing as we go into the next day or two, Parker, don't get too used to it, because we do have some more significant changes as we get towards the weekend heading into next week that'll return us back to reality.
Yeah, I got to enjoy it while we have it. Thanks, Cedric.
Hell yeah. Thank you.
And now with an update from the Utah Avalanche Center, I've got Drew on the line.
Hey, good morning. You know, we had overnight quote-unquote lows in the upper 30s last night, even some cases the low 40s. The window for being on supportable crust will be the window will be earlier and much more narrow than it's been the last couple of days. So I'd recommend sort of getting off steep avalanche prone terrain by mid-morning. The spring shed for wet avalanches really kicked in yesterday, and many wet loose natural avalanches occurred on many east, south, and west facing aspects. Even some low and mid elevation northerly facing slopes got into the action with some wet loose avalanches cascading down some steep north-facing couloirs yesterday. I mean, temperatures are even going to be even warmer today. So the danger is going to rise to considerable for wet loose and even some wet slab avalanches with free water percolating down to some of these structural interfaces. Those will be most pronounced generally on easterly and westerly facing aspects. Cornices increasingly tender. These huge monsters looming along the ridgelines are becoming weak and calving naturally. In some cases, triggering large avalanches beneath him, one in Provo in particular, that was about 4 feet deep. This cornice triggered a 4 foot deep, couple hundred foot wide avalanche there along the Cascade Ridgeline that ran over 2,000 feet. Wow. So it's not a good time to be in the mountains with the scorching temperatures and poor refreezes over the last few nights. Again, the danger is considerable on mm-hmm. many steep avalanche prone slopes. You should get all this information and more at UtahAvalancheCenter.org.
All right. Thanks, Drew.
Hey, thanks so much.
Coming up, Summit County Public Works Director John Angel joins the show to talk about flood risks as snow begins to melt. Then Park City Manager Matt Dias will preview this week's City Council agenda, which includes discussions on Deer Valley's development and the Treasure Hill conservation easement. Also, Tom Kammermeyer and Elliot Goldman will discuss the return of the Norwegian School of Nature Life and its Uinta Mountains programs. After that, stay tuned for the Mountain Life at 9. Dr. Robert Beeswas Diener and Professor Christian Van Neuerberg talk about their book, Radical Listening, which explores pathways to deeper and more fulfilling conversations. Then hear from young Park City locals, Griffin Briley, Josh Itoy, and Sam Kirshner, who competed in the recent SkiMo World Championships. They'll tell us all about this grueling sport, which they love, and that will make its Olympic debut in the 2026 Games in Italy. Getting into some local news now, some breaking news out of last night. During her annual State of Park City address Tuesday, Park City Mayor Nan Worrell told residents she doesn't plan to run for re-election.
But let me be clear. While I won't be running again, I'm far from done. Over the next 9 months, I challenge my colleagues on the City Council to step up, push past divisions, and deliver real results. This is not a farewell tour. It's a final stretch to drive meaningful progress on the issues that will define Park City's future.
The mayor outlined several objectives for the council to deliver on in 2025. Worrell said by June 1st, the council should pick a location for a new senior center. Also by that date, the mayor said the council should select a developer to move forward with its long-stalled project at the intersection of Bonanza Drive and Kearns Boulevard.
At the same time, I asked the council to finalize negotiations with the Kimball Arts Center on the parcel they will be purchasing within the 5 acres.
By September 1st, Worrell said the council should agree on a location for a new park and ride lot along the State Route 248 corridor. Deer Valley Resort pledged $15 million for such a project during negotiations with Park City over its Snow Park Village development.
Past experience has shown that turnover in council members often change the trajectory of projects that are underway. So let's make significant progress on a park and ride that can't easily be derailed by potential future changes in leadership.
The mayor also requested that the council agree upon a traffic and parking plan for the Main Street Corps as it considers major redevelopment concepts in Old Town by October 1st. By that time, she also said planning should begin on improvements for Miners Park to enhance the Main Street experience.
Finally, recognizing that our workforce is critical to the vibrancy and success of our community, I ask that the council immediately begin to work with local businesses to identify incentives to attract and retain workers.
During her time in office, Worrell has worked to help secure the return of the Winter Olympics to Park City in 2034. She's also played an integral role in discussions to keep the Sundance Film Festival in Utah as the nonprofit considers leaving the state.
Unfortunately, a recent bill passed by the Utah legislature and comments made by some legislature have not been helpful in our bid to keep the festival here. Regardless of the festival's trajectory, I am proud of Park City's efforts, and we will continue to support the arts and explore new opportunities. Change is inevitable with the festival, but if the Sundance Institute chooses to leave our state, we will not only survive, we will thrive.
Worrell made history when she beat incumbent Andy Bierman in the 2021 election to become Park City's first female mayor. She campaigned on stronger regional relationships, particularly with Summit County. Worrell previously held seats on the City Council and Planning Commission. Her term is set to expire in January, meaning Parkites will elect a new mayor this November. As of Tuesday, no one has publicly announced a campaign for the role. I'm now joined over the phone by Summit County Public Works Director John Angel. How's it going today, John?
Good. How are you today?
Pretty good. We wanted to have you on to talk about the warm weather as the snow begins to melt and what residents can expect. So I guess I'll just start, you know, with the, I understand we're only seeing warm temps for a few days this week, but certainly above average for what we normally see this time of year. What are you seeing conditions on the ground right now?
Yeah, you know, the streams and rivers seem to be handling everything fine. Of course, we haven't gotten near the snow that we had a few years ago,
right.
But with the warm temperatures, we can have isolated incidents. We're not really expecting too major of any flooding this year, but there is always that possibility.
Yeah, and what are areas you particularly look at just around the county that may be at more risk of flooding due to just the topographical nature of them?
Well, yeah, of course, we follow the streams. For us, McLeod Creek and Willow Creek, East Canyon, they're more early risers. And then as spring goes along in June and May and June, we watch more along Chalk Creek and Provo and Weaver Rivers. They don't reach their peaks until about the 1st of June.
Yeah, so when you look at just kind of past trends, not seeing much until kind of the months ahead is when we usually see the significant melt come down.
Yeah, any significant flooding usually begins about right now at the earliest. Of course, there is always isolated incidences, but typically this is just the beginning. But the amount of snow and the weather outlook, we're not expecting too severe of flooding this year.
Yeah, and you know, I wanted to get into just what homeowners and residents can do just around their properties, just containing any risks. I mean, what are kind of some of the top things that you suggest to homeowners just as the kind of snow melt season approaches?
Yeah, the number one thing is really just make sure your drains, gutters, things like that are not blocked. Even a small amount of water that hits a blocked culvert is going to cause problems. So making sure that all their drains, gutters, everything are cleared out. Grading around their property is big, but that should already be done by now. But you should always be looking for where water can come into your house and try to mitigate that.
Yeah, and just in your role, your department's role as Public Works, I mean, what is your job when it comes to this kind of time of season with the snow beginning to melt?
Yeah, well, our number one job is to make sure that the water crossings, that the roads and everything are cleared. Make sure that is our number one priority. We don't really go a lot on private property, but if we can take care of it within the right of way, that is where what we're looking to do. Hopefully that will alleviate it for everyone.
Yeah, and is there any distribution of sandbags, or is that kind of only an emergency kind of procedure?
We always have sandbags available. We hand out a limited amount of filled slime bags. Usually we try to limit to like 10, 12 per resident. But we always have sand and bags that they can fill their own.
Yeah, and so kind of turning back the last 2 years, obviously we've seen a lot more significant snowfall the previous two winters. How has the county been able to handle that runoff?
In 23, we were really pretty lucky. The weather was just perfect to get all that snow down without significant problems. There was isolated problems that we had to deal with and homeowners had to deal with, but overall, we were lucky with the weather. And I think trying to be prepared as possible by having things cleared, not clogging up and stuff like that is about all we can do. If Mother Nature wants to get us, she's a lot more powerful than we are.
Yeah. Do you kind of hope, I assume, for just kind of a more gradual rising of temperatures rather than something more kind of volatile?
Yeah, and, you know, the warming of temperatures and then cooling kind of in phases is really kind of an ideal situation where we can get that runoff started and then slow it down and just gradually peak and valley throughout the whole spring.
Yeah, and I guess just turning the page, looking forward, any exciting projects for Public Works coming up this summer?
Always exciting projects. We are still looking to finish the roundabout at Silver Summit. The asphalt and everything's in, but we still have some work to do there. We have a little bit of cleanup over on the Mammoth Drive job project. I guess one of the new big ones would be we're going to align and add a trail along Old Ranch Road. On the southern part of Old Ranch Road, that stretch that goes east and west.
Yeah.
We will reconstruct that road and add a trail to connect to the trail parking there on Old Ranch and connect that area down to Willow Creek.
Nice. And so that between that trail and the roundabout, does you expect to get those done this year?
Yes. We expect that work to be done this year.
What time do you guys expect starting construction on that roundabout?
We'll probably start some off-road stuff in May along Old Ranch Road. We're going to do some utility work and different things along that stretch first. Hopefully, as far as getting the roundabout and Silver Summit finished up, that should begin in the next week or two, assuming weather holds out for us. We don't want to make too much of a mud mess.
All right. Well, anything else you want to mention? Just updates from Public Works?
No, I think I would like to give a shout out to my plow drivers. Another year successfully done. They work hard. I think between December and February, they had 8 or 9 straight weekends that it snowed.
Wow.
It wasn't really an overly wet winter, but they all seemed to hit on their days off, and that makes for a long winter for them. So we appreciate all they do.
And I think I asked you probably a month or two ago about it, but you guys came into the winter pretty well staffed this year.
We did, yes. Probably the best staff we've been for the last 4 or 5 years. So we have some inexperienced guys that have learned on the fly, but we have had a really successful season with the personnel.
All right. Well, thanks for checking in with us, John. Appreciate the update. And just assume the Summit County website's the best place to go for anyone with looking for additional information.
Yes, there is for spring runoff. You can go to summitcounty.info/runoff, and that will give you information on the flooding or what there is. You can also go to summitcounty.info/getalerts for alerts of any emergencies that may be happening within the county.
Well, thanks again for joining us today, John. Appreciate all the updates. We've been speaking with Summit County Public Works Director John Angel. Do want to note that Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. It's 8:27 now, getting back into some local news. The Summit County Clerk's Office did not verify enough signatures to put a controversial Kimball Junction development to a countywide vote. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports on that.
According to the Utah Lieutenant Governor's website, 3,214 signatures were verified as of Tuesday. Monday was the Summit County Clerk's deadline to finish counting all of the signatures it received to put the county's development agreement with Dakota Pacific Real Estate on the ballot in November. Referendum sponsors needed at least 16% of all registered voters in Summit County to sign their petition, or about 4,500 signatures. Although they appear to have fallen short by roughly 1,300, Summit County Manager Shane Scott doesn't think this is the end.
I think there will likely be some dispute, whether it be the packets and numbers of signatures. I know that even the clerk's office will only verify those signatures that came in valid packets, and that may be in dispute.
KPCW emailed petition sponsors shortly after the Lieutenant Governor's website updated Tuesday, and they didn't immediately reply to a request for comment. They did write on their website, though she has 111 days after the signature deadline to make the call, we expect the clerk to officially declare the petition insufficient. When she does, we will pursue legal remedy to reinstate the rejected packets. Summit County Clerk Eve First tells KPCW 30 of the 77 signature packets her office received over the past month, quote, did not meet the petition requirements in Utah's election code. Full packets contain up to 100 signatures each, First saying some of the packets were full and some had as few as 10 signatures inside. First has cited photos she says show signature sheets circulating without a 160-page voter information packet, and she says those elements must be bound together prior to signing. But the seven residents sponsoring the referendum contended they follow the law. They say they've turned in more than 6,000 valid signatures by their March 3rd deadline. The sponsors may challenge her decision in court to raise the signature count, but hadn't filed a lawsuit as of early Monday. Summit County wasn't set to certify the referendum until June, after a 45-day period for signatories to remove their signatures. The clerks would also have time to make sure the signatures were spread across Summit County as state law requires. Meanwhile, Dakota Pacific is moving ahead with its controversial plans for a 725-unit neighborhood near Skullcandy's headquarters. The Summit County Council approved the development in December, agreeing to partner with the developer on additional county-owned affordable housing and an expanded transit center. As residents sought to reverse that decision, state lawmakers passed a law to give the developer the right to build anyway. Scott said Tuesday that Dakota Pacific has reached out to the planning department at Summit County about the law, Senate Bill 26.
They haven't moved forward, but they're talking about their next steps as far as that entitlement goes.
Under SB 26, which Governor Cox signed earlier in March, the company only needs administrative approvals from the county staff to build at Kimball Junction. More information is at kpcw.org, and Summit County's a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, leaders from PBS and NPR are appearing before the House DOGE subcommittee today to face questions about federal support for public broadcasting. The hearing comes after Georgia Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene, the committee chair, accused NPR and PBS of biased reporting. The subcommittee has titled the hearing Anti-American Airwaves, holding the heads of NPR and PBS accountable. The U.S. Committee on Oversight says CEOs of both companies will be asked why the outlets should continue to receive federal funding. Rocky Mountain PBS says, according to a 2019 survey from the Pew Research Center, 87% of respondents who identified NPR as their main source of political news identified as Democrats. In a podcast released Tuesday, NPR CEO Catherine Marr said she wanted to rebuff the idea that public radio is anti-American. PBS has reported a more conservative audience in the past, with data from 2016 showing 46% of PBS viewers identified as conservatives, with 31% moderate and 23% liberal. PBS, NPR, and their local stations, including KPCW, are funded in part by a $535 million appropriation provided by Congress through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, in addition to substantial foundation, corporate, and viewer donation support. Rocky Mountain PBS reports Republican administrations have been trying to end federal support for public media since the late 1960s. The hearing just began earlier this morning at 8 a.m. Mountain Time. It's streaming live on NPR, PBS, and our website, kpcw.org. I'm now joined in studio by Park City Manager Matt Dias. How's it going today, Matt?
Good morning, Parker. How are you?
I'm great. I did just want to do a quick react. Obviously, big event last night with the mayor announcing she's not going to run for re-election, but laid out some pretty big goals for the council to hit this year. Those all seem doable to you, the timeline?
Yeah, I think to be fair,
Yeah, we're excited about some deadlines and some additional accountability going into the mayor's last year. I think she was really clear that this last lap in her four-year term is hoping to be the most aggressive or perhaps the most productive. And I think the team, by and large, is just really excited to hear that level of focus and sort of the challenge that she's laid down for us and some of the deadlines to come back and, you know, at least be before the council. I think this dovetails really well with the city manager work plan that we'll also be discussing, where we lay out, you know, with existing resources, the projects, programs, and initiatives that are over and above the day-to-day operations. So if you bear with me, it's over and above salting and sanding the streets and day-to-day law enforcement and pedestrian control. This is sort of the strategic initiatives, the public-private partnerships, building housing, contemplating park and rides. So really excited the way these line up together. And then, you know, also it's a little bit bittersweet. The mayor has worked with members of these sort of administrative teams in the municipality for the better part of 15 years. So the mayor's been just a fixture at City Hall. And to be fair, knows every single member of our staff. It doesn't matter if you're in the library or the ice arena. And so a little bittersweet for us that this is our last run. But we're going to thoroughly engage and do everything we can to support her and her success in her last year.
Yeah. Two meetings this week for the city council. You mentioned the city manager work plan. That'll be discussed today. I believe that was a retreat item that was delayed due to the snowstorm that hit during that meeting. So from what I understand, it's kind of a priority discussion, but can you kind of talk about the council setting their priorities? Why does that matter when it goes into, you know, policy making?
Yeah, I think it's really important because it's sort of putting a mark in the sand with where we are with the level of resources that we have as an organization and how they're being applied that are twofold. One is the day-to-day operations that it takes to run our summer camps and our recreation leagues and offering library services and plowing our streets and providing public safety. And the second part of that is most cities and towns will contemplate sort of the things that aren't your day-to-day operations, which I alluded to before, that require cross-departmental collaboration, strategic thinking, sometimes special financing tools, negotiating with private partners, and they are far more cumbersome and they take a lot more time and sometimes they're more controversial. You know, sometimes it's not a controversial thing to have your streets plowed and maintained and the stop signs maintained. It's far more controversial when we're thinking about the future of land development, big transportation investments, how to serve some of the underprivileged populations in our community, and spending money on childcare initiatives and other aspects. And so this puts a mark in the sand with the things that we're going to be able to accomplish and when we intend to return with updates on them. And we're counseled to add, let's say, another big initiative, like another big public-private partnership or a new recreation amenity. We probably have to pull up this plan, and that's the intent, and say, okay, are we going to apply more resources, or what will we deprioritize or take off that's over and above day-to-day operations? So really, it's a communications tool. And I'm very excited about it. It's also an accountability tool. I'm really excited that it expressed clarity to my team and the individuals in the organization and with the council members and gives them something that they can hold us directly accountable for.
Yeah. Prior to that discussion today, the council will hear Deer Valley Resort's request to go forward with a public infrastructure district. I guess just for background, Matt, can you kind of remind listeners what this public financing tool will allow the resort to do?
Yeah, I mean, in short, you know, they're going to be reviewing a request to create sort of three distinct public infrastructure districts, which the nomenclature is PIDs in Utah, and they're called a bunch of different things in other areas. But it only covers sort of the property boundaries of the Snow Park Village. It's privately owned by Deer Valley Resort, so it doesn't impact other property taxpayers in our community. Well, they will be self-assessing themselves an additional property tax to help pay for some of the infrastructure to build that project, both public and private. And so we've contemplated this as far back as December 2023 when we first did our letter of intent with Deer Valley, and we obtained a $15 million agreement for them to contribute to a park and ride facility in exchange for vacation of our right-of-way and a bunch of other mitigation measures for that canyon, for the neighborhood, to mitigate traffic and congestion, to reduce parking. It's a pretty extensive agreement, and it has sort of multiple phases, and this is sort of the next logical phase.
And I did just want to ask about the evolution of that agreement, because I understand, as you said, it's a letter of intent right now. When When does that become kind of legally binding and official?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I get this one all the time. So multiple things are happening here. We began with a letter of intent that sort of expressed the order of operations moving forward with Deer Valley. That was the first step. And the next steps were the PID, as we just mentioned, and then also what's called a public-private partnership agreement, which is the actual details of how that $15 million is conveyed, how it's managed, and how it will be used for some type of transit and parking facility moving forward. So the public infrastructure district and the public private partnership agreement are two separate legal agreements that are both contemplated in that overarching letter of intent, mm-hmm. but they don't depend upon each other. However, the right-of-way vacation requires the adoption of both at the end of the day. So this is a complex order of operations. It's all spelled out in the letter of intent. There are multiple steps in that order of operations, and we are following them. So Deer Valley, said another way, is asking the council to take the next logical step under that LOI, voting to authorize the PID, and it's something that they need for their financing, but they can't, and we can't finalize the right-of-way vacation without both agreements being memorialized. So the two agreements are both contemplated in the LOI, but are otherwise unrelated. How's that for a word salad?
Yeah. All right, well, moving on, the council's got back-to-back meetings this week. Moving into Thursday's agenda, obviously a big item, the Treasure Hill conservation easement up for approval. You want to talk a bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, a long time coming for members of the public, for the property owner, for different members of the community, for Summit Lands. You know, we've been working on this for decades, dare I say. We're sort of here at maybe the final lap or getting down to the end, and I think, you know, we're working hard to try to cure this land once and for all. You know, we made the acquisitions. It's already protected as open space. I think it has two overlapping deed restrictions that already protect it as open space. And so this conservation easement was always contemplated as an additional measure, as like an additional safety precautionary measure for moving forward. And we're just sort of negotiating the last aspects with the conservation easement holder, which in this case would be Summit Lands. And dare I say, we're close, and there's still some loose ends that we're trying to wrap up.
Yeah, and I did want to ask specifically about the ski resort improvement section, because I understand there's just difference of opinion on how that should go about. Summit Lands wanted to kind of hold approval for any future possible improvement that could come, such as like a new lift or a lodge or something. Park City Mountain asked for that to be deleted, and the council agreed with that, so the approval would hold with the council. I mean, can you just talk about how specifically that language lays out what a future ski resort improvement would look like under?
Yeah, sure. I think I want to be clear. I don't know that council is being responsive to any particular request from the resort or otherwise. I think I've heard nothing but a desire from this council to protect Treasure Hill from development with the conservation easement, which is an additional protection to the two deed restrictions that already exist on that hillside. But that being said, I think, you know, some of this is trying to prepare for the unknown. I think the council has said, you know, we want to be careful about doing anything that might have unintended consequences for both ski and other recreational uses on that hillside. And it's clear that, you know, Summit Lands is weighing in and is also trying to prepare for the unknown, mm-hmm. and trying to do that together. And so maybe they're a little high-centered on, you know, how to figure out what none of us know will occur. But I think both sides are formally committed and nothing but a desire to protect the hillside from any type of development with the conservation easement. And it's a tough one because we're like looking into the future for just unknowns, not sure what will happen. But this is just about the ski operations. This doesn't have anything about development or like that.
Yeah. Well, moving on, looks like Park City Song Summit is moving forward with hosting an event in town this fall. The council will be set to approve, I believe it's a level 5 event permit, and that'll be in City Park?
Perhaps. So it's a request, and I think council heard the request earlier, maybe back in February, and there was some sort of loose ends to tie up with regard to parking plans and traffic and law enforcement operations. And so obviously this is sort of an innovative, well-loved, relatively new event in our community, and has great alignment with a lot of our community values. You know, at the same time, holding an event, a new level five event, has considerable impacts, particularly where it's being suggested in City Park. You know, parking, trash, noise levels, traffic and congestion, even damage to our fields and facilities. Now, we've been working really well with the event organizer, and this is their opportunity to come back and respond to those questions that the mayor and council mm-hmm. had, saying, how are you going to hold a level five in City Park and mitigate all of these impacts? And they'll be running through that. So I don't know if they'll approve the item tonight. I don't know if they'll have additional questions or continue the item with some additional requests. It could go either way.
Yeah. Moving on to everyone's favorite topic, water rates. I understand the council last year approved kind of a tiered setup, 4.5% rate increase over the next several years. So what's the discussion Thursday going to be about?
Yeah, I think without saying it again, this is a fairly big contemplative step back with regard to the single family rate structure. Probably the biggest that I've experienced in well over a decade here working for the municipality. But I think the moral of the story is, on the single family side, there's a feeling that we've achieved our conservation goals, and we've put in all sorts of measures to achieve those goals through penalty pricing and raising water rates over time. And we're really looking toward the next decade and how to right-size the system so our ratepayers aren't, let's say, behaving in the right ways and conserving water, but still incurring penalties mm-hmm. that are sort of a signal that their use is out of sync with the norm. And so if someone is receiving penalty pricing and these conservation signals in a way that feels like punitive, but really they're doing the things that we ask them to do, we're trying to right size for that. And so, look, in this town, historically, water's been cheap until about 10, maybe 12 years ago. And lots were big, and landscaping was really popular as this community sought to bring in new landscaping and make it more aesthetically pleasing. And so we are taking this step back where we're saying, look, if we just put the revenue constraints aside that would normally sort of drive the way we function, how would we program this? And so we're looking at kind of small, medium lot sizes, allocating a reasonable level of water that we can accommodate with our supplies, and trying to see what the revenue outcomes would look like. And one of those is potentially $1 million revenue decrease. However, we're trying to buttress that with saying, well, if that's the case, then maybe we need to meet that with cost controls and other types of efficiency measures, as opposed to just saying, well, let's find another $1 million to drive the rates up. So this is a really big step back, and it's sort of fun. It's been a creative exercise working with the water liaisons. We'll be moving into the council meeting now where we can have public input and public vetting. But effectively, this is the first time we've done something like this in well over a decade this comprehensively.
Yeah, and when you say like 10 years ago, water used to be cheaper, I mean, has that change just been driven by the development of the state?
I think it's a little bit of everything. You know, really proud of our public utilities team. As you know, we delivered the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant this year, which is arguably one of the most sophisticated water treatment plants, I'd say, in the Western United States at the moment, treating water out of both of our mines. And so it's sort of like coming off the high of delivering this huge piece of infrastructure, which is going to be here to protect culinary water in this community for the next 60 years, 80 years, but then at the same time not losing sight of our ratepayers and the people and our property owners that pay for the system. And so saying, after this milestone is reached, now let's take a step back and contemplate, you know, what the next decade should look like and what's a reasonable amount of water given our conservation signals. But water's gotten more expensive throughout the Mountain West, throughout Utah, a lot of different water bills at the legislature, given droughts and other things. And so we're fortunate to be at the top of the watershed. We have a bunch of different ways that we provide revenue to maintain our system. And we're really proud of the work that's being done.
Yeah, and I was saying there will also be a discussion on enterprise funds, which I believe includes water and like golf, and these are funds that have to stay balanced. Can you talk, what will this discussion be about?
Yeah, I think just to be fair, every once in a while, it makes sense to sort of take back and assess your underlying budget policies and principles. And we've had principles with regard to recreation and ice and golf and water over time about whether they were going to be an enterprise fund, which means they have to be self-sustaining or self-sufficient, or be memorialized with a subsidy from another funding source. And so, you know, when a fund or an operation is an enterprise fund, it's usually driven by rates or fees from the individuals that are consuming that service. And so sometimes that drives unintended outcomes or consequences. One idea is, you know, recreation could try to pay for itself, but then it would be really hard to have subsidized summer camps and swimming lessons and free drop-ins at the Mark. And so the council has different policies for these funds, and I think they've asked, does this make sense to have sort of three or four different policies for a recreation, for an ice arena and a golf course? Perhaps it does make sense to continue with the water fund, but there's a bunch of different ways of assessing these and looking at these. Every community does these differently. You know, my community didn't have enterprise funds that I worked for previously in the areas of recreation, ice, or that. But, you know, golf is a frequent area that is an enterprise fund. But that also doesn't mean it has to be balanced purely by the ratepayer. There are other ways to provide subsidies so that if you have goals like offering low-income programs, camps, or clinics.
Are enterprise funds as common in communities that maybe don't produce as much sales tax revenue as Park City?
Yeah, it really runs the gamut. And this is where, if folks are interested, if you read the staff report, our sort of recreation department, or the Mark, so to speak, I think as far back as 2004, used to be previously an enterprise fund. And I think I'm guessing here a little bit going back to the time machine, but that they were having a challenge reading this, you know, balanced budget and still offering all these community amenities at a subsidized rate and allowing high school kids to come in on vacation weeks and have open gym time without charging fees. And so council stepped in and said, look, recreation is something maybe we should all pay for, we don't all have to use, and there's a subsidy we can provide. So they actually took it out of being an enterprise fund. So my experience is, depending on the community goals and values and vision, you can either have an enterprise fund or you don't have to have an enterprise fund. It's just a different way of operating the system.
Yeah. Well, finally, Matt, I did just want to ask about the 5-acre RFP. I understand that closes at the end of the month. Can you just talk about what the process going forward will be like after the city receives its bids?
Yeah, thanks for asking. You know, obviously very excited to reach another milestone. We're going to be pushing really hard. I would anticipate once that RFP closes, we have basically formulated the exact same scoring committee we had on round one, which will quickly review the proposals and sends, I believe it's three finalist proposals to the mayor and council to begin their review and contemplation. They'll be scored and interviewed. My presumption is we'll likely have a special meeting. You know, council said they're willing to move heaven and earth to get this done quickly. So I anticipate a lot of progress this spring, and we'd love to be back in June with some type of a proposal to move forward in a partnership agreement with the vendor. So a lot of work's going to be done over, I'd say, the next 60 days. And so stay tuned, likely special meetings and otherwise. But we're at the precipice here. We've been working on this a long time. I will concede not everything's gone well, and it's taken probably too much time. But this group's really focused on this, and we're going to do everything we can to support them.
Yeah. Anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for coming in today. We've been speaking with Park City Manager Matt Dias. I'm now joined in studio by Tom Kammermeyer and Elliot Goldman. They're here to discuss the return of the Norwegian School of Nature Life and its Uinta Mountains programs. Well, I guess, guys, just to start out, tell me a bit about the Norwegian School of Nature Life.
You want to start, Tom?
Sure.
Yeah.
The school started in Norway, obviously, and then came to Park City in 1980. And since then, we've worked with over 18,000 youth participant days within the Park City, Summit County, and Wasatch County school districts and the locations, and taking kids out into nature and just experiencing this philosophy of friluftsliv, which we'll talk about, but it's this free air life or life in nature. Have them take off their watches. When they're hungry, they eat. When they're tired, they rest. And now we're incorporating some new aspects of it. So it's not just philosophical, but it's a lot more technical with avalanche awareness, route selection, and different aspects of getting us into nature.
Yeah, how did you get involved in this program?
Did my master's at the University of Utah, and was allowed to go back to Norway. And then wound up at the Norwegian University of Physical Education and Sports. And then we met our mentor, Nils Forlin, who founded the school back in Norway. And that's how I got involved with the philosophy. I went back to finish my master's and wanted to start something here in the Park City area, and it was in the mountains, and that's the way we got started.
Very cool. What about you, Elliot? How did you first get involved?
So, you know, Tom's school ran here in Summit County, I believe, from 1980 till about 2013. And I had become friends with Tom over at Riff's Acoustic Music, which I'm sure some people will remember, down on Iron Horse. I was teaching music lessons there, and Tom would kind of come and hang out and drink coffee. And Tom's also a great musician. You can catch him every Tuesday at Flanagan's. So we became friends with that, and then we stayed friends over the years. And I had, I had done NOLS, which is the National Outdoor Leadership School, when I was like a teenager, still in high school. And then after college, I worked for Student Conservation Association, which is an outdoor program that brings like high school age kids on service trips in the wilderness. So I was in Yosemite National Park for a month. So between those experiences and kind of always doing outdoorsy stuff, you know, on my own, I love whitewater rafting. I was into rock climbing for a while, backcountry skiing, backpacking, all that stuff around here. Between that and music education, I kind of found a little niche where I was like, hey, I could kind of incorporate these two things. And it was at that time that Tom's school had closed, and he was starting to work for other schools in the area. So I think it was about 4 years ago that I was kind of like, hey, Tom, like, do you need any assistance, or can I work with you somehow? Because the Norwegian Outdoor Education Center, which it was called at the time, was closed, but Tom was still leading kids on trips through another way school. And so I got hired there to kind of be Tom's assistant, and just fell in love with the whole philosophy, the whole program, and felt like I was able to bring some of these more technical skills that are more focused on teaching students, you know, how to safely explore nature on their own terms. Because if we just take them out on hikes and then take them home, you know, they're not learning how they could do this on their own and how they can kind of be set up for a safe and fulfilling life in nature, which is what the free-to-sleeve philosophy is all about.
Yeah, I apologize, guys. We're really short on time, but if we could quickly get into just what you guys are offering this summer and how people can get involved if they're interested.
Yes, yes. So our website, NorwegianSchoolOfNatureLife.org, will have all of that information. Because we just started and we're still fundraising, we are working on getting a van. That should happen soon. So we will be updating programs then. Right now, what we've scheduled is a 2-week summer camp in July. The dates will be July 1st through 3rd and 8th through 10th. So that's 3 days a week. There'll be about 4 to 5 hours. And what else on that? We will be offering that to age groups 7 through 11 to start. But hopefully as we go on, we can expand the age groups, expand all the programs, work with existing organizations, and just keep the dream alive.
Yeah, and Tom, in a minute, can you explain, I'm not going to try to pronounce it because it's not going to go well. Can you explain your spiritual motto that you two have cited and what that means?
The unselfish and simple life in nature. And just out to enjoy and be one with the mountains and get us back into the outdoors, because we're so foreign to nature today because of technology.
We love phones.
Yeah, and all the phones and the computers. And so it's just to some degree going unplugged, but we have them use the GPS. And so I don't get too philosophical. We're finding a balance between the philosophy and what the kids really want to get involved with. And eventually we'll be working with adults.
Yeah, Elliot, just want to give out that website again, just for people that are interested. What was it?
Yes, it's NorwegianSchoolOfNatureLife.org.
And you guys will be going out to the Uintas?
Yes, we do. We try to do all our trips in the Uintas, because we find, as lovely and amazing as our trail system is here in Park City, it's often, there's a lot of bikes, a lot of people, very busy trailheads, you know. So we find in the Uintas we're able to kind of get that serene nature experience that we're trying to get all these kids, and not be, you know, getting bikes whizzing by us and stuff like that.
Yeah, we've been speaking with Tom Kammermeyer and Elliot Goldman with the Norwegian School of Nature Life. Thanks so much for coming in today, guys. Apologize for cutting it short.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Tusen takk. A thousand thanks.